And he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of the sun. 2 Samuel 12, verses 9 to 11. What a solemn exhibition of God's governmental righteousness. David must reap as he had sown. He had caused Uriah to be slain by the sword, and now God tells him, the sword shall never depart from thine house. He had committed adultery with Bathsheba, and now he hears that his own wives shall be defiled. How true are those words, for with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged, and with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. Matthew 7, verse 2. God hath declared that to the froward he will show himself froward. Psalm 18, verse 26. And frequently does he punish sin in its own kind. Upon the burning lusts of the Sodomites he rained down fire and brimstone from heaven. Genesis 19, verse 24. Jacob deceived his father by means of the skin of a kid. Genesis 27:16, and he in turn was thus deceived by his sons, who brought him Joseph's coat dipped in the blood of a kid. Genesis 37:31, saying he had been devoured by a wild beast. Because Pharaoh had cruelly ordered that the male infants of the Hebrews should be drowned. Exodus 1:22. The Egyptian king and all his hosts were swallowed up by the Red Sea. Exodus 14:28. Nadab and Abihu sinned grievously by offering strange fire unto the Lord, and accordingly they were consumed by fire from heaven. Leviticus 10:1-2. Adonai Bezek cut off the thumbs and toes of the kings he took in battle, and in like manner the Lord rewarded him. Judges 1:6-7. Agag's sword made women childless, and so his own mother was made childless by his being torn in pieces before the Lord. 1 Samuel 15:33. What proofs are these that the eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good? Proverbs 15:3. What evidences are these of the inflexible justice of God? None need fear but what the judge of all the earth will do right. What solemn intimations are they that in the day to come, each one shall be judged according to his works. What warnings are these that God is not to be mocked? But let it not be forgotten that if it is written, he that soweth to the flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption, it is also added, though not nearly so frequently quoted, that he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. Galatians 6:8. The same principle of God's granting an exact quid pro quo applies to the service of his ministers. He which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. 2 Corinthians 9:6. The harvest shall not only be answerable to the seed and the reward to the work, but it will be greater or less according to the quantity and quality of the work. Nor does the last quoted passage mean that God is going to reward his ministers according to the fruit and success of their work, but rather according to the labor itself, be it little or much, better or worse. Every man shall receive his own reward according to his own labor. 1 Corinthians 3:8. God in his sovereignty may set his servant over a blind and perverse people, as he did Ezekiel, who, so far from profiting from his ministry, add iniquity to their iniquity. Nevertheless, his work is with God. Isaiah 49, verse 4. So too, with the rank and file of Christians, the more bountifully they sow the seeds of good works, the more shall they reap. And the more sparingly they sow, the less will be the harvest. Knowing that whatsoever good thing any man doeth, the same shall he receive of the Lord. Ephesians 6, verse 8. What an incentive and stimulus should that be unto all of us. Let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap, if we faint not. Galatians 6, verse 9. But to return to David. And Nathan departed unto his house. 2 Samuel 12, verse 15. The prophet had faithfully delivered his message, and now he withdrew from the court. It is very striking and blessed to see how God honored his servant. He moved David to name one of his sons Nathan. 1 Chronicles 3, verse 5. And it was from him that Christ, according to the flesh, descended. Luke 3, verse 31. And the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife bare unto David, and it was very sick. Verse 15. The prophet's words now began to receive their tragic fulfillment. Behold here the sovereignty of God. The parents lived, the child must die. See here too God's respect for his law. David had broken it, but he executes it by visiting the sins of the father upon the son. David, therefore, besought God for the child, and David fasted and went in and lay all night upon the earth. Verse 16. It is touching to see this seasoned warrior so affected by the sufferings of this little one. Proof of a broken heart and a contrite spirit, for the penitent are pitiful. It is true that the prophet had said, "The child also that is born unto thee shall surely die." Verse 14. Yet David seems to have cherished the hope that this threat was but a conditional one, as in the case of Hezekiah. His words, "While the child was yet alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who can tell whether God will be gracious to me that the child may live?" Verse 22 strongly appears to bear this out. In his fasting and lying all night upon the ground, David humbled himself before the Lord and evidenced both the sincerity of his repentance and the earnestness of his supplication. What is recorded in verse 17 illustrates the fact that the natural man is quite incapable of understanding the motives which regulate the conduct of believers. And it came to pass on the seventh day that the child died. Verse 18. No detail of Scripture is meaningless. It was on the eighth day that the male children of the Israelites were to be circumcised. Genesis 17, verse 12, and so forth. Thus, in the death of his son, before it could receive the sign of the covenant, a further proof was given David of God's governmental displeasure. Though it was a mercy to all concerned that the infant was removed from this world, yet, inasmuch as its death had been publicly announced as a rebuke for their sin, verse 14, its decease was a manifest chastening from God upon David and Bathsheba. Then David arose from the earth, and washed, and anointed himself, and changed his apparel, and came into the house of the Lord, and worshipped. Then he came to his own house, and when he required, they set bread before him, and he did eat. Verse 20. This is very beautiful, reminding us of Job's bowing beneath God's chastening rod and worshipping him when he received tidings of the death of his children. How different was this from the desolate grief and rebellion against God which is so often displayed by worldlings when their loved ones are snatched away from them. Weeping should never hinder worshipping. Is any among you afflicted? Let him pray. James 5:13. How the terms of this verse rebuke the personal untidiness of some who attend public worship. And David comforted Bathsheba his wife, and went in unto her, and lay with her. And she bare a son, and he called his name Solomon. And the Lord loved him. Verse 24. Having meekly bowed before God's rod, humbled himself beneath his mighty hand, and publicly owned him in worship, David now received a token of God's favor. Behold, a son shall be born to thee, who shall be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all his enemies round about. For his name shall be Solomon, and I will give peace and quietness unto Israel in his days. 1 Chronicles 22:9. The birth and name given to Solomon was an evidence that God was reconciled to David, as it was also an earnest of the tranquility which would obtain in Israel during his reign. Solomon was also named Jedidiah, which signifies beloved of the Lord, signal demonstration of the sovereignty of divine grace. The chapter closes, verses 26 to 31, with a brief account of Israel's capture of Rabbah, the royal city of the Ammonites. Further proof was this of God's grace unto David. He prospered his arms, notwithstanding his aggravated sins. The additional chastisements which came upon him under the governmental dealings of God will be considered by us, God willing, in the chapters which follow. Chapter 58. His son Absalom. 2 Samuel 13. The chastenings which were the natural fruits of David's sins quickly began to fall upon him. Though God had made with him a covenant ordered in all things and sure, 2 Samuel 23, verse 5, and though he was the man after his own heart, yet he was very far from regarding his sins lightly. The honor of Jehovah's name required that such transgressions as David's should be marked by no ordinary tokens of his displeasure. He had given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. 2 Samuel 12, verse 14. And therefore did he proclaim his disapproval more loudly by suffering David to live and pass through one tremendous sorrow after another than he had slain him instantly after his crime against Uriah. Yet we may also behold therein the faithfulness, wisdom, and grace of God towards his servant by using those very sorrows for the renewing of him in holiness. That this was accomplished appears blessedly in the sequel. David was now to prove to the full the solemn truth of thine own wickedness shall correct thee, and thy backslidings shall reprove thee. Know therefore and see that It is an evil thing and bitter that thou hast forsaken the Lord thy God, and that my fear is not in thee, saith the Lord God of hosts. Jeremiah 2, verse 19. It was through those nearest and dearest to himself that David was to experience what an evil thing and bitter it is to depart from the Lord. Behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house. 2 Samuel 12, verse 11, the Lord had declared. What must have been the feelings of his poor heart with this dread threat hanging over his family? How often do we moralize upon the wisdom and mercy of God in withholding from us a knowledge of the future? How it would spoil our present peace and comfort if we were acquainted with the trials and sorrows lying ahead of us. The more so if it were now revealed to us the evils which would yet overtake the members of our household. But the case was otherwise with David. He knew that the sore judgments of God were about to fall within his family circle. One can readily imagine with what trepidation David would now look upon his several children, wondering upon which of them the divine blow would first fall. The death of Bathsheba's infant was but the prelude of the fearful storm which was about to descend upon his loved ones. It seems quite clear from all that follows, one of the family failings of David was that he had been too easygoing with and indulgent toward his children, allowing his natural affections to override his better judgment, instead of, as it should be, the judgment guiding the affections. It is not without reason and meaning that the head is set above the heart in our physical bodies. No doubt the fact that David had several wives made it much more difficult to rule his offspring as duty required. How one wrong leads to another. As we have seen in earlier chapters, David was a man of strong natural passions, and the deep feelings he cherished for his children was in full accord therewith. The fear of his servants to tell him that his infant was dead, 2 Samuel 12, verse 18. The advice of Jonadab to Ammon, who had read David's disposition aright, to feign himself sick that when his father came to see him, 2 Samuel 13, 5, he might proffer his requests. His weeping so sore for the death of this son, and then again, his anguish having subsided, his soul longing to go forth to the other son who had slain him. 2 Samuel 13, verse 39. And the final instructions to his officers touching the safety of Absalom, even when he was in arms against his father. Deal gently for my sake with Absalom. 2 Samuel 18, verse 5, being far more concerned with the care of his child than the outcome of the battle, are so many illustrations of this trait. But that which throws light upon the doting fondness of David for his children, a fondness which caused him to set aside the clamant calls of duty, comes out in his failure to punish Amnon for his crime against Tamar, and his failure to punish Absalom for his murder of Ammon. What light is thrown upon this infirmity of David's when, in connection with Adonijah's rebellion, his father had not displeased him at any time in saying, "Why hast thou done so?" 1 Kings 1, verse 6. Little wonder, then, that his own offspring were made a scourge to him. Alas, he followed far too closely the evil example of Eli. the high priest of Israel, of whom it is written, his sons made themselves vile, and he restrained them not. 1 Samuel 3:13. Wisely did Thomas Scott say, children are always uncertain comforts, but indulged children surely prove trials to pious parents whose foolish fondness induces them to neglect their duty to God, end of quote, who requires them to duly discipline their offspring. Yet David's children had been preserved from open wickedness in their early years. It was not until their father became guilty of aggravated crimes that the restraining hand of God was removed from them. How this should speak to the hearts of parents today, if they forsake the paths of righteousness, there is good reason to believe that God will chasten them by suffering their offspring to do likewise. Children in their youth naturally consider the evil example of their parents an excuse why they may follow in their steps. And grown-up ones, too, are emboldened and confirmed in sin by the sinful conduct of fathers and mothers. Again, to quote Thomas Scott, let this be a warning to us to watch and pray against temptations, lest by the misconduct of one unguarded hour we should occasion such future consequences to our offspring and such misery to ourselves throughout our future lives. End of quote. It is both deeply instructive and unspeakably solemn to observe the method followed by the Lord in the execution of his awful threatenings through Nathan. It was not that David's palace was now burned by fire from heaven, or raised to the ground by a cyclone, nor was it that one of his sons was killed by a flash of lightning and another swallowed up by an earthquake. No, that is not God's customary way, not by physical miracles, but by the operation of moral laws is the retribution meted out by his government conducted. Alexander Carson wrote, God denounced the most grievous afflictions against the house of David on account of his conduct toward Uriah. Those afflictions were all executed in a way of providence. Every part of the divine sentence against David was executed by his providence without a miracle. Who can work like God? Unquote. This is exceedingly striking and worthy of our closest attention, for it casts much light upon God's government over the world today. Yes, the manner in which God's awful threatenings were fulfilled is most noteworthy. It was done in a way of natural consequence from David's own transgressions. The curse which God pronounced upon him corresponded exactly to the character of his iniquities. He had despised the commandment of the Lord, 2 Samuel 12, verse 9, namely, thou shalt not commit adultery, by taking to himself the wife of another man, and now the women of his own household should be defiled. He had become a man of blood in the butchery of Uriah, and now of blood his own family should be made to drink. He had yielded to his lusts, and by that same baneful passion in others, was he to be scourged for the rest of his days. The complexion of his remaining years was set by his own conduct in the palace at Jerusalem. And though David himself was spared from the violent hand of the avenger, yet he was long made the spectacle of righteous suffering before the world. In marked contrast from the opening of 2 Samuel 11, chapter 12 closes by showing us David occupying again his proper position. There he slighted the post of duty, but here he is seen at the head of his people fighting the battles of the Lord. In the previous case, David was made to pay dearly for his fleshly ease, but here God prospered his efforts by delivering Rabbah into his hands. After the victory, David and his army returned to Jerusalem, yet only for him to suffer one calamitous grief after another. The chapter which is now to be considered by us chronicles two of the most horrible crimes which ever disrupted the harmony of a family circle. One of David's sons now dishonors David's daughter, while another of his sons, after biding his time, revenged the outraged honor of his sister by murdering her seducer. Thus, lust and fratricide now desolated the king's own household. David's children had learned the lesson which the fall of their father had taught them. Tragic indeed was the harvest the king now reaped, for a parent can have no sharper pang than the sight of his own sins reappearing in his children. Alexander McLaren said, David saw the ghastly reflection of his unbridled passion in his eldest son's foul crime, and even a gleam of it in his unhappy daughter, and of his murderous craft in his second son's bloody revenge. End of quote. There is little need for us to dwell upon the revolting details. First, Ammon had determined to commit the fearful sin of incest against his half-sister, who was fair or beautiful. 2 Samuel 13, verse 1. Ah, how many a young woman has grieved because she was not pretty. Alas, good looks often prove to be a fatal snare, and those endowed with them need to be doubly cautious. The most solemn features of this first calamity may be seen in tracing the workings of God's righteous retribution in it. First, we have the Spirit's time mark in the opening words of our chapter. And it came to pass after this, which, as we have intimated, was when the king had returned to Jerusalem, where his own fearful fall had taken place. Second, Ammon was the king's oldest son, 2 Samuel 3, verse 2, and therefore the one in immediate line for the throne, and probably the one he loved the most. Third, Ammon was at a loss to think of means for the gratification of his base desires. But there was at hand a cunning counselor who promptly devised a plot whereby he succeeded. And that man was a nephew of David's, verse 3. Fourth, the workings of providence were such that David himself was made an unwilling accessory to his daughter's ravishment. When the king saw Ammon, who pretended to be sick, God not only withheld from him a discernment of his evil designs, but David was the one who sent for Tamar. As poor Uriah had been deceived by him, now he was deceived by his son. After gross insult, verse 17, had been added to her grievous injury, Tamar found a home with Absalom, who was her full brother. His question to her, verse 20, indicates that the character of Ammon was well known, which renders the more excuseless the king's consenting for his daughter to visit him. Yet, the counsel of the Lord, that must stand, Proverbs 19, verse 21, and though it evidenced his severity, Romans 11, verse 22, nevertheless, it was what even this world would designate a case of poetic justice, so far as David was concerned. The more closely the case be examined, the more will appear the righteous retribution which characterizes it. As Joab had been so far from refusing to execute David's wicked plan, but had been a willing party to the same, 2 Samuel 11, verse 15 and verse 16, so Jonadab, instead of recoiling with horror from the vile design of Ammon, helped him to secure it. But when King David heard of all these things, he was very wroth. Verse 21. A severe testing of his character was now presented, for it must be remembered that as king, he was the chief magistrate in Israel, and therefore under the highest obligations to see that the law of God was impartially enforced. Merely to be very wroth by no means met the requirements of the case. As the head of the nation, it was his bounden, though exceedingly painful, duty to see that his debauched son was punished. The law was very express concerning such a case. See Leviticus 20, verse 17. Yet there is no intimation that David inflicted this penalty. Was it the workings of his own guilty conscience calling to remembrance his sin, or parental softness toward his offspring which deterred him? Whichever it was, a dangerous precedent was set. For mildness unto transgressors by magistrates only serves to encourage greater evils. But though the king failed in his public duty, later on the Lord dealt with Ammon, and in such a way as to greatly add to David's domestic trials. And Absalom spake unto his brother Ammon neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Ammon because he had forced his sister Tamar. Verse 22. The Holy Spirit now introduces to our notice one of the most despicable, vile, and God-abandoned characters whose record is chronicled in the Scriptures. The first thing that we learn about him is his antecedents. He issued from a heathenish stock. His mother was a Gentile, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. 2 Samuel 3, verse 3. The Geshurites were a fierce and intractable people, and the strain of their lawlessness passed into his blood. In taking Maacah unto himself, David disobeyed a plain command of the Lord. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. Deuteronomy 7, verse 3. Need we wonder then that having sown the wind, David was made to reap the whirlwind? God will not be defied with impunity. B.W. Newton writes, to Maacah were born Tamar and Absalom. Both were fair, both attractive. In all Israel, there was none to be so much praised as Absalom for his beauty. From the sole of his foot even to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. David probably was proud of the attractiveness which adorned his house, and was willing to forget the source from which it sprang. The attractiveness wrought its effects, and as might be expected, from the attractiveness of nature, the resulting consequences were sin and sorrow. The beauty of Tamar was the cause of sin and destruction to Ammon, who fell beneath the revengeful hand of Absalom, his brother. And the attractiveness of Absalom wrought on the hearts of the men of Israel till they were drawn away from David and his throne. Such were the results of an attractiveness derived from sources foreign and forbidden to God's people. Little wonder that Mr. Newton went on to ask, has Christianity profited by the lesson, or has it also formed alliances with the stranger? End quote. Alas, that these questions are so easily answered. One of the chief reasons why poor Christendom is in such a sad condition today is because she has been so largely attracted by that which makes an appeal to the flesh. Nor is this evil by any means restricted to Rome, with its ornate architecture, imposing ritual, appeal to the senses. The same thing in varied forms now blights the greater part of Protestantism. The plain exposition of the scriptures is replaced by the popular topics of the day. Congregational singing has been pushed into the background by professional vocalists in the choir, and all sorts of worldly devices are employed to draw the young people. All of this is but the present form of Israel being allured by the physical attractions of a godless Absalom. Singularly enough, the meaning of Absalom is the father of peace, but his was the peace of a deceiver. He was the child of him that was a liar and a murderer from the beginning, and he knew no other master. There is not a single intimation that God ever had any place in his thoughts. The deceitfulness and treachery of his character appears from the beginning. His words to Tamar were, "Hold now thy peace, my sister. He, Ammon, is thy brother. Regard not this thing." So Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house, verse 20, apparently with no suspicion of his murderous intentions. Meanwhile, Absalom spake unto his brother neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Ammon because he had forced his sister Tamar. The spirit of revenge consumed him, and he only waited his time for a suitable opportunity to exercise it. Absalom was the rod appointed by the Lord for the further chastening of David, a rod, as we have seen, taking out of his own stem his own child. The mills of God grind slowly, but they grind exceeding small. Chapter 59. His son Absalom continued. Tamar, David's daughter, as we saw in the last chapter, found an asylum in the home of Absalom following the vile treatment which she had received from Ammon, another of David's sons, but by a different wife. Her brother, we are told, hated Ammon because he had forced his sister Tamar. Nor did Absalom's enmity abate at all with the passing of time, but merely waited an occasion which he deemed would be most suitable for taking his revenge. This only served to make more apparent his real character. There is an anger which is sinless, as is clear from when he, Christ, had looked round about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts. Mark 3, verse 5. Yet, There is so much of a combustible nature in the flesh of a Christian that he needs to turn into earnest prayer that exhortation, "Be ye angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath." Ephesians 4, verse 26. But the sun had gone down upon Absalom's wrath. A deadly fire burned in his heart, which 2 full years had no power to quench. His crafty soul biding its time until a way opened to let out his rage on its victim. Implacable hatred burned in Absalom toward his half-brother as though it had been kindled but yesterday. And now his subtlety devised a sure passage for it. He was most manifestly a child of the devil, and the lusts of his father he was ready to willingly execute. The guide of the serpent now ministered unto the fury of the lion, for those are the 2 predominant characteristics in the archenemy of God and men. This is clear from the tactics he followed with our blessed Lord. First, we see his venomous guile in the temptation, and then his fiendish cruelty at the cross. Similarly, does he work now, and thus it ever is with those whom he dominates. And it came to pass, after 2 full years, that Absalom had sheep shearers at Baal Hazel, which is beside Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the king's sons, 2 Samuel 13, verse 23, corresponding to the old English custom of harvest home, when a time of feasting and merriment followed the garnering of it. In Palestine, the annual occasion of sheep shearing was made an event of festive celebration and of the coming together of relatives and friends. This is clear from Genesis 38, verses 12 and 13, and 1 Samuel 25, verses 4 and 36. For in the one we read, "And Judah was comforted after the death of his daughter, and went up unto his sheep shearers in Timnath with his friend," while in the other we are told that Nabal did shear his sheep. "And behold, he held a feast in his house like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunken." During quite a lengthy interval, Absalom had concealed his bitter hatred against his half-brother under an appearance of indifference. For we read that he spake unto him neither good nor bad. Verse 22. But now Absalom deemed the time ripe for his murder. To cover his base design, he invites all the king's sons to his feast, which he had purposed should be the place of execution for his unsuspecting victim. Only the last great day will reveal how often treacherous designs have been cloaked by apparent kindness. Judas betrayed his master not with a blow, but a kiss. In his long and varied experience, the writer has found in every instance that his worst enemies fawned upon and flattered him to his face and then stabbed him behind his back. Yet sufficient for the servant to be as his lord. But Absalom went to yet greater pains to hide his base intention. And Absalom came to the king and said, "Behold now, thy servant hath sheep shearers. Let the king, I beseech thee, and his servants go with thy servant." Verse 24 of 2 Samuel 12. That was downright hypocrisy, for Absalom could have had no desire that David himself should be on the ground to witness the treachery against his son. nor was the success of his cunning plot endangered by this vicious move, for he had good reason to believe that his father would decline the invitation. Such indeed was the case. And the king said to Absalom, "Nay, my son, let us not all now go, lest we be chargeable unto thee." How that evidenced one of the many noble traits of David's character, his unselfish thoughtfulness of others, his kindly consideration by refusing to put his son to unnecessary expense. And he pressed him, yet a little later, sought to turn the hearts of all Israel against him and wrest the kingdom from his hand. Howbeit he would not go, but blessed him, verse 25, that is, pronounced a patriarchal benediction upon him. Then said Absalom, "If not, I pray thee, let my brother Amnon go with us." Verse 26. Here was the real design of Absalom in pressing the king to be present himself at the forthcoming family union and feast. Having considerately declined his son's invitation, it would be doubly difficult to refuse his second request. Yet how this pretended deference unto David's parental authority exhibited the perfidy of Absalom. He was determined to get Amnon into his toils, yet veiled his bloodthirstiness under a pretense of affection and filial respect. And the king said unto him, "Why should he go with thee?" Verse 26. David was evidently somewhat uneasy, or at least wondered, what lay behind the outward show of Absalom's friendliness toward Amnon. But the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord as the rivers of water. He turneth it whithersoever he will. Proverbs 21, verse 1, and so the sequel clearly demonstrated.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying His word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important when he says that God had commanded no such thing and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.